one of the weakest fundamental skills that students have, or actually field providers have, are vital signs. I'm a huge advocate for complete, thorough, accurate vital signs, mm-hmm. Defining what vital signs are. I love to ask students, you know, what if you use the, if you take the word vital and define it, it actually means essential for life. And if you take the word sign, that's obviously just something that we see, some kind of signal that we can visually see. But if we think about it, not all the vital signs that we accept in EMS are truly vital. We have, let's just take, for example, we have blood pressure, we have pulse, we have respirations, we have skin signs, and we have pupils. So generally speaking, those are the five core vital signs. Some people might put pulse ox in there, somebody might put glucometer in there, somebody might put level of consciousness. And I believe those are all important. But for the last 20 years, I would say those five, blood pressure, pulse, respiration, skin signs, and pupils have been the core set of vital signs. And what I try to get students to do is understand, to actually triage those five and decide, try to get them to think critically. Which of those five, first of all, are they vital? Are all of them vital? And students will often, you know, if I said, okay, which of those five is the least vital, the least essential for life? And generally speaking, either skin signs or pupils will come up. People almost mm-hmm. always say that. Even an inexperienced student early in a semester of an EMT class will say either pupils or skin signs. And many times it's pupils. And so we can say, okay, great. So if pupils are bad, if they're actually showing death, what do they look like? Well, they look dilated. Great. Okay. Can you be alive and have dilated pupils? Well, the answer is yes, you can. Either through drugs or medication or some damage to an eye, you can have a pupil that's dilated, which would normally show signs of death. And so that's really not it's not a reliable sign of life in and of itself or death. And then we go to skin signs. I say, well, what does someone look like when they're dead? Well, they look pale. Okay, can you look pale and still be alive? The answer is yes. So we immediately come to the conclusion that, okay, so skin and pupils are not reliable vital signs to tell us whether someone's alive or dead. Now, they can help create a larger picture and a more clearer picture, complete picture of a patient's status. So if we just sort of put those aside for a minute, we'll still put them in the vital sign category, but we'll just set them aside and talk about the other three now. So we've got blood pressure, pulse, and respirations. So I'll ask students, think about this for a minute. And if I said, I'm going to ask you, which of those vital signs, which of those three provide you with the most amount of information about your patient with the least amount of effort? Which one would you come up with? Which of those three vital signs, blood pressure, pulse, or respirations, provide you with the most amount of information about your patient with the least amount of effort? You got a guess?
I would pick respirations.
Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, you can walk into a room and from a distance, with a little bit of practice and a little bit of skill, a little bit of instruction, be able to, in most cases, assess, at least initially, the respiratory status of a patient. You're not going to hear lung sounds necessarily, but you're going to see chest wall movement. You're going to see abdominal movement. You might hear them a little bit if they're snoring or gurgling, but you can get that information literally as you step into the environment where the patient is without ever touching the patient. And in some cases, if it is audible respiration, somebody's wheezing, gurgling, stridor, crowing, any of those things, you can actually do that with your eyes closed. You can get a rate. You may not have the depth, but you can get a rate and sort of is it labored, is it not, just simply by listening. So I try to get students to understand that it's you know, if a patient is breathing, then by definition, they have a blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for a pulse. If a person is breathing, by definition, they have a pulse and they have a blood pressure. Now, we don't know the values of those. We don't know if they're in the normal range, the abnormal range, but at this moment, it doesn't matter. What we know is we have a patient who's moving air, and we've assessed that without ever touching the patient. Mm-hmm. One of the things that kills me in the classroom when trying to teach students about vital signs is we teach them blood pressure and we teach them how to take a pulse and how to count respirations. And we do that all very actively. You have to be touching the patient. And after students get comfortable with vital signs, I will then ask a group of students to respond to a scenario, and I will have taken their blood pressure cuff out of their response bag. They didn't know it, but I took their blood pressure cuff. So they get on scene to a chest pain, a respiratory difficulty call, and they start to work this patient up. They start to ask the history, and then someone reaches in the bag to grab the oxygen because they're going to put some oxygen on this patient. Then the other person reaches in the bag to grab the blood pressure cuff, and there is no blood pressure cuff. And so they continue to treat this patient. They don't take a blood pressure and subsequently don't take a pulse or respirations and just sort of forget about skin signs and pupils. So they did a pretty good history. They gave the person oxygen. They're all ready to go, and we'll stop the call and I'll do a critique. And I'll ask the question, so why didn't we get vital signs? And the answer almost every single time is, well, we didn't have a blood pressure cuff. Oh, so because you don't have a blood pressure cuff, that means you can't take any vital signs at all. And I just let them think about that for a second. Right. And they realize when they hear it back from me how ridiculous that sounds.
Yeah.
And that they realize that, wow, wait a minute, we could have gotten 4 out of the 5, even if we didn't have a blood pressure cuff. And then they realize that it's not all about blood pressure. So from that point forward, I asked them then, so if you said that respirations is the most important vital sign. No, it's the vital sign that provides us with the most amount of information with the least amount of effort. I didn't say it was the most important. I won't even go there necessarily. Right. But let's just say because of that, it is, we'll label it as the first, we'll put that at the top of our list. So it's respirations comes first. So of the next two vital signs, pulse and blood pressure, which of those provides us the most amount of information with the least amount of effort?
You have to go with the pulse.
Great. You have to go with the pulse because all you need to do is touch the patient somewhere with a couple of fingers in a particular place with a particular amount of pressure, and you'll actually obtain a pulse rate, a heart rate on that patient. So I have the students then prioritize these vital signs in their head and on a piece of paper. They write down the word respirations first. They write down the word pulse second. They write down the word blood pressure third. They write down the word skin signs fourth, because that's another vital sign. Now we're going to add into the mix because I want them to always get those 5. Mm-hmm. But now it's again, what between pulse and between skin signs and pupils, which of those gives you the most information with the least amount of effort? And generally skin can be more easily assessed than pupils. You might have to shield the eye from light to really see a response. You might have to use a pen light to see some response with the skin. You can visually see it when you walk in the room, at least 2 of the 3 characteristics. You can see color and moisture. And the only thing you'd have to do to touch the patient is to get temperature. So we actually now triage these vital signs and we put them in an order that makes more sense to them. Prior to this, students will take, and this still happens in the field. You ask somebody to take a set of vital signs on 3 or 4 patients, or ask 3 or 4 people to take vital signs on the same patient, and they're all going to give you a set in a different order.
Yeah.
Okay. With no real reason other than that's the way I've always written them. And if we push it even further, they're going to say, well, the reason I write them that way is because that's the way I was taught in the book, or somebody just told me the teacher wrote them that way on the board. That's their only reason.
Right.
So now students can actually say, here's why I'm writing them in this order, because they actually have a priority.
Yeah.
I begin to assess them in this order because that's how I approach the scene. I want to know right away if they're breathing, because if they're not, then I might have to do CPR or something.
Right.
At least I might have to ventilate. So students come away with a much better understanding of what vital signs are, why they, which ones are actually truly vital and which ones are not so vital, and be able to say, gosh, I get all the way to the hospital and I actually forgot to check the pupils. Is that really that important?
Right.
Not if you had actually taken all the others and done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I try to get across to the students is, together, let's decide which ones are the most important. What order should we take them? Why should we take them in that order? And then we talk about completeness. I will ask students to take a set of vitals on one another and then write them on the chalkboard. They'll write them up there and they'll write 120 over 80 for a blood pressure. Well, actually, they'll write 16 for a respiration, because now this is the order they're going to record them in. They'll write respiration 16. They'll write pulse 84. They'll write blood pressure 120 over 80. And everyone will write them on the board. Everyone sits down, and I turn to the class and say, you've all failed. You've absolutely failed this lesson. Why? And I get them engaged in a discussion of looking at all those vital signs and what's the common trend. And in fact, they have only, and then they don't know. They don't know. So I say, you've only given me one third of a picture that has three parts to it. Let's just take, for example, the respirations at 16. Respirations have a three parts to the picture. The complete picture of respirations in our world, not including lung sounds, has three pieces to it. Respirations mm-hmm. have the rate, they have a depth, and they have a ease. I call it the ease. So the rate we know, that's the one they got. They got 16. The depth they left out and the ease they left out. The depth has to do with tidal volume. Are they breathing in a normal tidal volume? Are they breathing a volume that looks normal for a person in their condition? If they're really stressed out, the volume might be a little greater. If they're just sitting quietly on a couch, actually it might be a little bit less. And I also put in perspective to them, go home and watch somebody who is sleeping. Somebody who is sleeping is usually breathing normally. And normal respirations, in fact, are very shallow. We could easily describe normal respirations as shallow. They don't become normal until we see somebody who's on a narcotic overdose mm-hmm. and truly is breathing shallow and at a rate of six times a minute. Once you see that, all of a sudden, normal breathing comes into perspective. But early on in their career, EMTs and paramedics even can misread normal respirations in an unconscious patient, thinking that they're too shallow or the rate isn't enough. So then we'll look at pulse. I say, okay, well, pulse is the same thing. Pulse has three characteristics, not one. And what are those characteristics? And they'll tell me rate, strength, and rhythm. So now go back and take your pulse and tell me what it is. And of course, they'll come up with a whole bunch of words, but we'll define some very simple words. Going back to respirations real quick, rate, depth, and ease would be 16 with good tidal volume and unlabored. That would be a very accurate, concise way to describe normal respirations. We don't like to use the word normal, and we don't like to use the initials WNL. Which most people come to know as within normal limits. Mm-hmm. As an educator, I know it means we never looked. Because if you actually took a blood pressure and then on your PCR documented it as WNL, then why didn't you write the number?
Right.
It really tells me you didn't look. And you're making a passive assumption that they have normal vital signs because they're conscious and alert and giving you a history. Mm-hmm. And so I really warn them against using a form or even documenting within normal limits, WNL. So 16, good tidal volume, and unlabored is a very accurate and concise way to describe respirations. If we go on to pulse, it would be 84, strong, and regular. If it's weak and irregular or weak and regular, there are just a few words we want to choose to describe each of those characteristics, but we want to describe the rate, we want to describe the strength, and we want to describe the rhythm. One of my soapboxes is around other words that are meaningless to us. The word thready has no meaning in EMS. Nobody I've talked to can tell me the definition of thready. Okay. It is a word. Well, I didn't know what it meant, so I went to look it up. I looked it up in Stedman's medical dictionary, and it said thread-like. Okay, well, that didn't tell me anything. And so I did a little more research, and I had to find a cardiologist who actually described it for me. And thready means, in fact, does mean thread-like, and is oftentimes when someone has a low blood pressure and a weak pulse, it will appear very narrow, as in the narrowness of a thread below the skin. As that pulse is pulsating, it's very thin to the touch. On the opposite side of thready is a pulse, is a characteristic called full. A full pulse is somebody generally with a good blood pressure, good perfusion. And although a full pulse can also be described as strong, I mean, generally, if you have a full pulse, it's strong.
Right.
It is felt as a wider feeling below the fingertips, as a rope or as a cord. Now, those are two characteristics, or thready is a characteristic we wouldn't even venture to get our people to try to understand in the field. If they get a rate and a rhythm and a strength, they are light years ahead of where we want them to be. I mean, they're just, that's right. Exactly what we want. Forget Thready, throw it out of your vocabulary. You don't know what it means anyway, and stop using it. Stop documenting it. Keep it simple. The other characteristic is the pulse. The sign is the blood pressure. Now, I can tell two ways that students aren't really taking a blood pressure. Well, they're taking it, but they're not really obtaining it. It takes a long time to really understand and master blood pressures and the sounds and differentiate the sounds. So students will always say, first of all, they'll say it as a question. I say, what'd you get for blood pressure? And they'll say 120 over 80, as if it's a question. So I know right away they're not sure. They may have heard one number. They may have heard the bottom number, the top. They may have not heard either one, but they feel compelled to give me a number.
Right.
So I say, no one will ever believe you if you say 120 over 80, even if it really is.
Yeah.
So tell me 122 over 78, and I might believe you. But if you're going to lie, don't say 120 over 80, you know, even if it really is. I just say that almost jokingly. So it's funny because my students take it seriously. Now, no one ever records a 120 over 80, ever. And I'm sure somebody out of 36 people is 120 over 80. But I stress to them that you will not get a blood pressure every time. You will not get both numbers every time. You might get just the top. You might get just the bottom. Give me what you've got and just be honest. Say, I wasn't able to hear the top number, the systolic, but I believe I heard a diastolic of 80 or 82 or whatever you got. And then go back and try again, but don't give up. And if you didn't hear it, tell us you didn't hear it. I was unable to obtain a blood pressure because I couldn't hear, because it was noisy, because the stethoscope was moving as I was lowering the pressure on the gauge. But be honest and tell us you weren't able to get it. I tell them to try at least twice on the same arm before trying the other arm or asking someone else to give it a try. Because as you're learning, you can be frustrated. And of course, the patient's arm is going to be hurting if you're going over and over again and keeping that blood pressure cuff inflated. So be patient with yourself. Give it a couple tries. And then I show them the technique of taking a blood pressure by palpation. You're better off getting a palpated pressure, which is generally easier to obtain than learning to use a stethoscope and taking it by auscultation. So try twice through auscultation. If you don't have any luck, go to a palpation and at least get a reading so you have something to begin to trend.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FizDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.